You're listening to Nick Luck Daily, bringing you the latest news and the best interviews from around the world of horse racing. This episode is brought to you by the Racehorse Owners Association, by Thoroughbred Racing Commentary's Global Rankings in partnership with the Saudi Cup, and by the Fitzdares Club. Hi there, welcome to the show, bringing you the latest news and sharpest insight from around the world of horse racing every weekday. It is Tuesday, February the 23rd. My thanks to Tom for doing such a brilliant job filling in yesterday while I was on duty judging the Godolphin Stud and Stable Staff Awards. Even happier that Beck Edmonds was the winner and that she will be on this podcast a little later. But yesterday, the government announced its roadmap for the lifting of lockdown restrictions. A four-stage plan. David Yates, newsboy from the Daily Mirror, is with me today. Dave, how does this impact racing, both immediately and in the longer term?
Let's look at the details first for the roadmap or plan, if you prefer. Four steps for the lifting of restrictions between March the 8th and June the 21st. They're at five-week intervals. That's so that the data can be analysed to see how things are going. So the first step is March the 8th, the second April the 12th, the third May the 17th, and the fourth is June the 21st. Now, as far as horse racing is concerned, apart from March the 8th, and I suppose the stopping of homeschooling, which has driven many of you mad, though I've been blissfully free from it. April the 12th, the opening of non-essential retail. That, of course, means betting shops. That's step two. Step three, May the 17th, the return of crowds of up to 4,000 or 50% of capacity on racecourses. That, of course, brings in the likes of Goodwood May and the Derby at the start of June. And then step four is June the 21st, and that is for the return, basically, of full houses. England play the Czech Republic in the European Championships on June the 22nd, and a lot of the papers are full of this morning are full of the idea that there could be a full house at Wembley. So June the 21st is the last of the four steps. That means the return of full houses. Tantalisingly, that date is 2 days after the end of Royal Ascot, and of course April the 12th is 2 days after the Randox Grand National is due to be staged at Aintree.
Dave, let's talk about Aintree first of all. Marcus Townend in today's Daily Mail and our own colleague on this podcast, Cornelius Lysett, have both reported this morning that the Betting and Gaming Council and the bookmakers are in talks with the British Horse Racing Authority and possibly ultimately with the Jockey Club with the idea of moving the Grand National so that it can coincide with the opening of betting shops 2 days after its proposed date at the moment, or indeed moving it to the following week. What's your position on that?
Well, I don't like the phrase no-brainer, Nick, but I think that the case for moving the National is absolutely compelling. I was talking about it last night with a couple of people. The obvious date is April the 12th, the Monday, and to have the first 2 days on the Saturday and the Sunday, obviously. You could consider moving it a week later, but then of course that causes a domino effect and that's much more difficult to arrange. Of course, you've also got Punchestown in Ireland to think of too. So I think we're looking at April the 12th. Have to make sure that ITV are happy with it, but in terms of horse racing, I can't really see how anybody would object to this. The turnover on the Grand National is 150 million quid. The levy receives 3 million quid of that, of which in 2019 that was split 50-50 between retail and online. So working using those figures, if we were to replicate that turnover on April the 12th, that would mean 1.5 million quid goes into the coffers. We moved Betfair Super Saturday 8 days when there was snow and frost about the place, so why we wouldn't be able to move that. You couldn't do it if there were crowds coming to the races, but there won't be anybody in terms of crowds going to Aintree this year for the Randox Grand National meeting. So to me, as I say, I don't like the phrase no-brainer, but I think it's a compelling case. I spoke to a bookmaker's representative early this morning. He said that it would be hard graft for betting shops to put in place all the measures they would need in terms of social distancing, etc. But he added in the same sentence that the betting industry would bite your hand off for the opportunity to open and have the Grand National as their first day of business. The other thing, just before I close, is that whilst there's a reputational issue to deal with, and even recently there was a piece, I think it was in The Guardian, about Cheltenham, the last year's Cheltenham Festival and COVID-19, what this would do with betting shops is give them the opportunity to open with a bang. We wouldn't be saying, oh yes, I saw Ladbrokes was open, or other betting shops was open, I went past and the lights were on this afternoon. It's big news because, of course, everybody is going to, not everybody, but a large proportion of the population are going to a betting shop, or would go to a betting shop on April the 12th in order to have a bet on the Grand National.
And the last time there was a Monday Grand National was when Lord Galeen triumphed famously on Monday afternoon to a huge TV audience on the BBC, and surely that would be replicated on ITV, but it is only a thought at the moment, and one that'll have to be considered carefully by all the relevant parties over the next few days. What about Royal Ascot? Now, this is trickier because they're scheduled to take place from the 15th to the 19th of June, as Dave was telling you, and the final phase of restrictions are due to be lifted on the 21st of June. So it's simple, isn't it? They just push it back a week to get a maximum crowd. That's the question I put to Nick Smith, the Director of Communications and Public Affairs.
Well, it's absolutely natural that that question would be asked, and it's the first racing question that came out of the announcements yesterday. I think the reality is that what the Prime Minister has actually said is that the 21st of June is the earliest that that phase, which he's called Stage 4 or Step 4, would come into operation. So with Royal Ascot due to end on the 19th of June, if it were to move a week later, that doesn't give an awful lot of room for slippage. So at this particular point in time, you know, bearing in mind all the complexities of moving a race meeting, the pattern issues, the fact that people have got rollovers and what have you, and the real uncertainty as to whether the 21st of June will become tenable, we're just watching this space. I mean, I wouldn't want to set hairs running and say that there is a plan in the background to move the Royal Meeting, because A, it's too early to even think about that, and B, obviously there isn't at this stage. But I think we have to be realistic that it's not impossible. Some would say it's probably likely that there will be some slippage in this programme, which won't mean it's failing. It will just mean that the natural course of events aren't as quick as everybody would like. So it's extremely complicated. And of course, you know, saying 1 week we could plan for X thousand and the next week we could plan for maybe, you know, 70,000 capacity or what have you, would require a huge amount of build and a huge amount of expenditure, which, if you aren't absolutely certain you're going to be able to deliver it 1 week later, would be, you know, financially very difficult risk to take, especially in the context of what we faced last year and what we continue to face as an industry this year.
But what you do know is that unless something extraordinary happens, you will be able to accommodate at least some crowd, even in the current dates from the 15th to the 19th of June.
Yeah, that's the really great news, isn't it? I mean, that now appears to be likely. I wouldn't go so far as to say highly likely, because, you know, we've had so many setbacks as a sport. All sports had so many setbacks in over the last few years of sort of false dawns. But this really does look like a plan that is deliverable and that we can all properly aim for. We don't quite know what that number's going to be. It's difficult because the government have detailed what you can accommodate per your stadium, which for a stadium that is purely seat based. And of course, race courses don't really operate like that, so there'll be some kind of a new coefficient, if you like. I imagine that race courses will be judged on vis-a-vis the size of the stadium itself and seating and just general area, and we'll come to a number in due course, I suppose.
Nick Smith there, the Director of Communications and Public Affairs for Ascot. Dave Yates is still with me. What do you make of that?
I'm not surprised there's a hint of caution, Nick. As with other areas of life, the further you look down the line, the more uncertain things become. We can talk about April the 12th and moving the Grand National and stuff like that, because we've got a pretty good idea, given the data that we've got at the moment, what the situation is going to be. But 10 weeks later, it's much harder to know. And so I can see why they're not ruling anything in or out. as Nick referred to slippage there, I think that that could go either of two ways. They could look at the data and say, right, we've decided to delay things, or they could actually look at the data and say, right, we're going to bring things forward. But certainly, if you do move the meeting to a week later, and then the data isn't so good, there's some sort of spike that means that the plans are shelved, then you've really created something of a knot of vipers for the rest of the season, haven't you? So I can see why that's a cautious approach. I left Ascot on Saturday evening in the gloom, and I look forward to the Royal Meeting in June. I thought of the summer sunshine and the fashions, the horses, all those lovely silk toppers, but I think we might be jumping the gun to think of a full capacity.
Did you mention silk toppers?
Yeah, just the antique silk toppers that that gentlemen wear in as part of morning dress. Yes, indeed.
Yes.
Yeah, I thought that's what you meant. Let's turn to matters more immediate. Obviously no crowds for the Cheltenham Festival, but nothing unexpected there.
Yes, that's right. That's not going to come as a massive surprise, is it? I think, well, you've had it on the Nick Luck Daily. It's been in the papers as well. Going back weeks and months, that Cheltenham have had to take something of a cautious approach to that, say they're not expecting anything. And of course, now it looks as though we're just going to be running the Cheltenham Festival behind closed doors.
And there's been plenty of talk on this podcast and elsewhere about sponsors at the Cheltenham Festival and the rather fluid nature of them this season for understandable reasons. Good news is that McCoy's Construction, West Midlands-based building firm, has been announced as a sponsor of the County Hurdle, which is good news. So well done to the Jockey Club for securing another commercial partner. Let's talk about this weekend's action, and some of it might well be considered to be last-minute festival trial material, Dave, particularly at Kempton.
Yeah, Kempton, as ever, is an interesting card. We've got, looking ahead to the Grand National, Cap du Nord, one of Christian Williams' two hopefuls for Aintree on April the 10th. He runs in the Close Brothers Handicap Chase. But yes, there's that clutch of Grade 2 races that are potentially pointers towards Cheltenham. We've got Tritonic in the juvenile hurdle. Of course, a decent flat performer scored over hurdles for Alan King at Ascot on debut. And in the same race, we've got Eros du Seuil of Nicky Henderson's, who also looks a promising four-year-old. There was a piece by Bruce Millington in the Racing Post some months ago, and Bruce and I could hardly agree on the day of the week, I think it's fair to say. But he said, when horses leave one country, they should be able to be renamed before they run in another. And I completely concur with that. We're so full to the brim now with French names that don't mean anything. I've no idea what Eros du Seuil means. And I would love for Joe and Marie Donnelly to have had the opportunity to give that horse a better name before he had run in Britain.
Now, Dave, you talk about British trained horses with funny French names. You could argue that the most interesting horse running this weekend and in that very same race, the Adonis Hurdle at Kempton Park, is a horse with a very English name, Margaret's Legacy, for a French trainer, Hugo Merrien, but in the colours of British-based owner Brian Dunn. Hugo trains in Chantilly, and he joins me now. Hugo, an exciting venture. A horse who's only 25-1 for the Triumph Hurdle. Ned Curtis, formerly with Nicky Henderson, is going to take the ride. Tell me about the plan.
Hi, Nick. Thank you very much for this call. The horse is going in Kempton on the weekend on Saturday. He's supposed to leave Friday morning to Garrymore. We'll take him to the racetrack. The horse is in good form. Went to the breast on Saturday, worked really well. We're quite happy with him. I think he improved from his meeting. He was a bit backward as a 3-year-old. That's why we understand something similar, but we could have got to Otay earlier if we were ready earlier. But it's a really nice horse. We really like him, very forward. And now the horse is ready. We don't have races in France over right now, so well for this kind of horse, and I think he will do well over in England, over English hurdles. Wouldn't be a problem for him, so we're trying this year with him. We'll see.
And he's a horse who as I say, has the Triumph Hurdle entry. You've got some idea as to how he stacks up against the domestic four-year-old hurdlers, the juvenile hurdlers in France. Where would he sit in the pecking order in France?
It's quite different because we've got a lot of avances. We start our trial a bit earlier, so yeah, this horse has only run twice in Cannes-sur-Mer. Now if I have to wait March for the Prix d'Amdi as a great three of hurdles in March for him, which he could have gone, but he's going to run against horses that run five or six times already in Auteuil. He might have a lack of experience of there, so I thought it would be a nice idea to go over in England, give him a bit more experience as well, and he's a horse that travels well, does everything well in the morning, good mental, very forward, and it wouldn't be a problem. I think it would be easier for him to go in captain against horses that run twice or as much as him than against horses that run already five or six times over hurdles in France and know the track and know the course and the distance, and it's totally different. It'd be
okay, so
it'd be a better experience for him, for the horse, so that's why we come to Kempton. It's only 6 hours away, it's not that far. It's hard to know where we are and where we're going, but from what he shows in the morning, I think he has a chance, so let's try.
And Brian Dunn is the owner. Brian's had a number of good horses trained in the UK down the years with Nick Williams and Neil Mulholland and others. Are you reaching out to try and attract more British owners to your stable in Chanty?
Well, yeah, why not? But you know, I think we're a bit short in our mind over gems compared to the flats. You know, when the flat program is more Europeanized, you know, we'll be thinking over here only about our national program, when I think we've got opportunities across the channel, and you know, it's more about the timing for the horse than about the program. So right now the timing is good for him to go over, and that's why we bring him over, and it's one of the reason. And you know, I don't want to shut my mind to some opportunities, which I think is good for the horse. So yeah, we're coming over. It's not only to get to get English owners. It's because for the horse, I think it's a good choice, you know.
Hugo Merriam there, and I wonder if that horse, Margaret's Legacy's name, features in this year's Weatherby's Cheltenham Festival betting guide, because this is Tuesday and this is the day when we go around the bloodstock world with our friends at Weatherby's. This guide has been published for a number of years, latterly by Paul Ferguson, who joins me now, and it's been a bit of a labour of love the last few weeks. We're out later this week, and Paul, are you pleased with the finished product?
Morning, yeah, yes, well, I'm still waiting to see it. Hopefully get to see it later this week when we go officially publish on Friday. But it was good to get it over the line and get it off to print last week. It's obviously a fraught last week or 10 days getting it there. But yeah, looking at it on screen, I'm delighted with how it looks. The team in head office have done a great job with the layout and things. So as well as incorporating, obviously, focusing around the trends and statistics like it has done for the past 22 years, the book now, we try and welcome in other readers and people who might be interested in other side of things, just make it more accessible to everyone. So there's a lot more in there these days.
So what new aspects of the book can we look forward to this time?
I'd say, as well as the every race is covered, for the past couple of years we've incorporated Aintree into the guide as well, so a bit more in that respect. From my own personal perspective, trying to bring it in line with jumpers to follow. We have a spring horses to follow section, which covers horses which not necessarily will head to the big spring festivals, but should certainly be worth following in the next few weeks and months as the season comes to an end. And there's plenty of editorial insight from others as well. The book is produced now in conjunction with Sport and Life, and there Ben Linfoot and Mac Brocklebank are contributors, as are Don McLean, who takes an in-depth look at the Irish View, and Rory Delargue, who takes on the Bankers or Bus Challenge for the sure price favourites on each day of the festival.
And obviously, given the fact that you're sponsored by Weatherby's, there'll be a focus on the champion bumper. I've got to confess, I haven't got a clue outside Kilcrut who might win that race, but surely that's a bit too boring when looking for something a bit more imaginative than that.
Yeah. The champion bumper, I've actually covered. I covered the bumper division in detail, and rather than just looking at the potential runners, obviously that race doesn't close till the 2nd of March next Tuesday, so we don't know the definite entries there, but you've touched on Kilcrut. He's going to be popular. I think the top end of the market's strong. I think you've got two potentially very smart bump horses in him and Sir Gerhard. So I wouldn't be surprised if the champion bumper was a slightly smaller field this year, and perhaps some of the other horses look elsewhere. Maybe Aintree. We know Eileen Dover's going to take on her own sex in the mare's race at Aintree, which I think is a wise move. I think she'll be difficult to beat there. As for the champion bumper, again, I'll touch on one more horse called Three Stripe Life. Gordon Elliott's got an abundance of talent there this year. He could send over a horse called Jerry Colombo, but I think he'll stay on home soil. So Three Stripe Life, if he comes over on soft ground, he'd be one to note. He won at Navan first time out, beating a horse called Outlaw Peter, who I believe has since joined Paul Nichols and Andy Stewart. So he's possibly one to look out for over here in the closing weeks of the season, because he looked a surefire winner when finishing second on debut.
Excellent. And I gather you're with me with Joseph O'Brien's Fred Winter horse.
Bustleton, yeah. I think, well, we will know next week what weight he gets. I'll be looking forward to seeing him. I assume he'll be given an entry today in the Fred Winter. His mark in Ireland is 1.33. He's also actually flagged up at the start of the season in the French section of jumpers to follow. I like this victory over there. He's done nothing wrong in two graded races in Ireland, so I assume he'd get a few pound extra. He'd be pushing towards the high 130s, but I think that'll be a fair mark for him coming over for that. And just touching upon that bit of French form from O'Toy, he beat a horse called Stateman, who I've been looking out for. He looked a surefire future winner when finishing runner-up. He come from a long way off the pace to chase Owen Bustleton at O'Toy, and he has since moved to Willie Mullins and is in the ownership of the Donnellys. He actually holds an entry in the Triumph. I'm not expecting him to turn up and go. Obviously, they've got French Seal for that, but it just shows the regard, and obviously he's showing up well since moving to Willie Mullins. So again, he'd be a name to note in the concluding weeks of the season.
And there's only one handicapper, I gather, you've backed so far. So now you've backed him, you can tell us all what he is.
That's Imperial Alcazar in the Potemps final. I was pretty impressed with his victory at Warwick. The race kind of fell apart a little bit, but I think the race, the final, will be run to suit. He'll be held up on the new course. I think that over hurdles, that certainly helps. He holds a stayers hurdle entry, but having gone up £8 to a mark of 1.47, and Fergal O'Brien's still looking for that first festival winner. I'd be amazed if he didn't run in the Potemps final. I think he looked sure to run a massive race. Although I was at Haydock on Saturday when there was a big eye catcher and Champagne Platinum in the qualifier there, and I noticed this morning he's only gone up £1, so I think he'll prove popular in the betting in the next couple of days.
Well, Paul, best of luck with it. I hope it goes really well. Don't forget the Cheltenham Festival betting guide. It's published Friday, the 26th of February, so this Friday. And there's a promo code for podcast listeners, LUCK21, which gives you £5 off print or digital, or the print digital bundle. And you just head to the Weatherby's website for more information. Paul, thanks so much.
Cheers, Nick. Best of luck. Bye.
Paul Ferguson. Now, my thanks to Tom Stanley for filling in so brilliantly yesterday while I was on duty for the Godolphin Stud and Stable Staff Awards judging. The ceremony took place last night live on Racing TV. 6 winners were read out, all brilliant winners as well, by ITV's Ed Chamberlain. And then 4 of those 6 went in to be judged for Racing Employee of the Year, Stud and Stable Staff Employee of the Year. And the winner was Beck Edmonds, who works for Brian Smart, and Beck joins me now. Beck, congratulations again. How are you feeling this morning?
Yeah, I'm okay. I'm still in shock. It's fantastic, and I'm so proud and grateful to have been put forward, let alone to have won, and to have won the whole thing. It's crazy. It really is.
So you go through all these stages and then you get to the final day and you're there. I know normally you would be in a big ceremony in London, but you were there on Racing TV last night being beamed in on Zoom. After you'd won the first category, had you given even any thought to the idea that you could end up being the Employee of the Year?
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. I was just thrilled absolutely thrilled to win the leadership award, because that's my job at the end of the day. And, you know, to be rewarded for just doing what you do every day is amazing. And I could see my phone in the corner of my eye and it was going mad with all the congratulations coming through. So it didn't really enter my head until my little face was up there in the final four. So it was unbelievable.
And we could see your husband Kevin with you in the shot. He and you have been quite a team in more ways than one. Just tell everybody about that.
Yeah, I mean, we've always worked together ever since we met years ago. We got married in 2002 after a very sort of short engagement, and moved up to Brian Smart's in 2005. Kevin started a couple of months before me, and I came into the yard as a stable lass, if you like. And then gradually worked my way up into head girl position when Kevin went to be assistant trainer. And we bounce off each other, you know, we both got the same sort of outlook. We always put the horses first. If a job needs doing and there's nobody to do it, we will do it ourselves. It's, we're a good team. We're a good team. And the aim of the every day is to get the lads finished on time with the horses being cared for first and foremost.
And it's not just about caring for the horses. We know that, particularly this last year, there was a huge focus last night on caring for people as well. And how hard have you found that through the last 12, 14 months, sort of just making sure that you keep everyone's spirits up?
Yeah, obviously I'm very passionate about mental health, and it's so important to communicate with your staff. And I was lucky, and everybody should do it. I went on a mental health awareness course that had been put on by Race and Welfare. And I've also enrolled to do the mental health first aid course now. And that helped me a lot to be able to then help the staff in the yard. Just talking every day, making sure, checking in with them, trying to boost their spirits with tiny little things, you know, little chocolate bar here and there. You know, it might seem stupid, but it puts a smile on someone's face, and it rolls. You know, they say a smile can travel around the world, and it can, and that's part of my job, and I hope I do it well.
Well, I think it's been proven that you do it extremely well. What really struck me was the way in which you really wanted to take the yard somewhere new. It wasn't just a question of a career progression, doing this and then moving on to something else, then moving into a different. It was your passion for taking where you are, the place that you're in, and the people you're with to a sort of a happier place, a better place.
Yeah, I mean, our yard, it is in the most beautiful place, but when the weather's bad, it is bad, and it's nasty and it's hard work, and I love it up here. You know, I'm not from Yorkshire originally, but this is my home now, and the lads that come to us, they don't just come to us as you know, people, they join our family, if you like, and I'm so proud of the yard for that. And I just wish there were more yards. I think in the future, the yards need to take on board more about communication with the lads, finding out their backgrounds, finding out about them. And you'll turn your yard into a family very easily just by communicating a bit more. And our yard, we've got that. You know, we all know everybody inside and out, really. And you can see when someone's having a bad day, and it's very easy to pick them up.
Beck Edmonds, the Employee of the Year at the Godolphin Stud and Stable Staff Awards. Fantastic ceremony last night, and hopefully come the summer, a celebratory get-together is the order of the day. David Yates, hopefully, is going to send me home with a winner.
Right, we're going to the 305 at Taunton, and it's seemingly so. A horse who disappointed on heavy ground last time, but prior to that, two good runs on soft. Ollie Murphy turns up the cheek pieces to blinkers today. Let's hope that it has a positive effect. Seemingly so, 305 at Taunton.
Dave, thank you very much. Thank you very much for listening. A reminder that exclusively to listeners of the Nick Luck Daily podcast, FitzDares are offering money back as a free bet if your horse is beaten by a length on day one of the Cheltenham Festival. FitzDares.com/luck for more details. We will be back with you tomorrow. That was Tuesday, February the 23rd. Bye-bye. You've been listening to Nick Luck Daily, brought to you in association with FitzDares, the Racehorse Owners Association, and Thoroughbred Racing Commentary.